Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 25th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, determining the size of the proton, the race to name all the species on the planet, and crusaders for science.
What they've started realizing is that there are pressures on scientists that can really contribute to some of that bad scientific behavior, which again doesn't necessarily excuse it, but it may help explain some of it.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Though it's the simplest and smallest of atoms, hydrogen has driven physics from Bohr's 1913 model to the quantum electrodynamics of today. Its key role has been to tie together experiment and theory as physics grew. This week, Aldo Antonini and colleagues report the most precise measurement of the size of the proton, based on how it appears in muonic hydrogen, a special form of hydrogen in which the electron is replaced with a muon. From his office in Switzerland, Antonini spoke with me about the mismatch between his result and earlier findings.
So the motivation for our experiment was the measurement of the proton radius, an order of magnitude more precisely than from other experiments. In order to do that, we have made use of so-called muonic hydrogen, which is an atom composed by a proton and a muon. By doing laser spectroscopy, that is by measuring energy level in this muonic atom, we have determined the proton radius with relative accuracy of 5 times 10 to the minus 4. Our result is very precise, but we are in disagreement with measurements from electron scattering and from hydrogen spectroscopy.
So your study and these earlier studies were looking at the size of the proton, either using electron scattering or using spectroscopy. What does size actually mean in this context?
So as everybody knows, atoms are made up of negatively charged electrons, which are orbiting positively charged nuclei, composed by proton and neutrons. So the electron, as far as we know at least, are point-like. They are mathematical point. Just to give an idea, their size has been inferred to be of the order of 10 to the minus 20 meter. So 0 point and then 19 zero and then 1 meters. The protons, on the contrary, are composite compounds. Therefore, they have a size. Protons are made of quarks which strongly interact with each other in a very fascinating way by exchanging gluons. And the fact that they are made by several particles, which moves and dynamically interact, this gives rise to the size of the proton. So the proton has a size of about 1 femtometer.
So you say about. So is this size set, and why is it important to be able to make an accurate measurement of the size of the proton?
Well, the size, it is roughly known with a precision of about 1%, let's say, just to give an idea. And why it is important, I mean, the answer is twofold. First of all, it gives us information to understand this quark and gluon dynamics within the proton. On the other end, the proton size is important to understand the hydrogen atom, which is the most simple atom. This simplicity, because this atom is made of only two particles, one electron and a proton, allows very precise theoretical prediction of the hydrogen energy level.
Okay. So there are a few different ways of measuring the size of a proton. Can you talk about some of them and which ones that you used in your study?
Yes, in fact, there are three ways to determine the proton radius. The first one, the historical one, is by using electron-proton scattering. So in this experiment, electrons are scattered off by protons by shooting basically an electron beam on hydrogen gas. And from the angular distribution of this electron, the proton radius has been determined. So it is worth to mention that this method has been awarded with the Nobel Prize to Hofstetter and co-worker. The second way, which started in the 80s and 90s, is based on spectroscopy of hydrogen atoms. There you, by using laser, you measure very precisely energy level in hydrogen or transition frequency to be more precise, and from that the proton radius can be deduced. The third way is our method, which we used for the first time in 2010, which is based on spectroscopy on muonic hydrogen.
What is muonic hydrogen?
Muonic hydrogen, it is a so-called exotic atom. It is composed by a muon and a proton. Basically, you start with an hydrogen atom, you kick away the electron, and you replace this electron with a muon. To produce the muon, we need a large accelerator, and from this accelerator, we get the largest amount of muons that are required to pursue our experiment.
So what difference does it make when you replace an electron with a muon?
That is a very good question. So basically, the muon is very similar to the electron. It's basically the cousin of the electron. It interacts with the other particle very similarly as an electron, but it's 200 times heavier than an electron. And because of this, the orbit of this muon are much closer to the nucleus compared with the orbit of an electron in a normal hydrogen atom. And therefore, the muons really feel the size of the proton.
So you can kind of judge from how close or far away it is from the proton a little bit more about the proton size.
Yes, exactly. Basically, in muonic hydrogen, the electron is replaced by the 200 times heavier muon. Therefore, the muon is orbiting quite close to the proton compared to a normal hydrogen atom. And in fact, the muon may even move within the proton. And by being within the proton, it feels a smaller attractive force to the proton.
And so that helps you to measure the actual size of the proton.
Yes, exactly. When the muon is inside the proton, it sees only a reduced electric charge. And therefore, the attraction between a muon and proton is reduced. And therefore, the energy level of this muon, in this muonic hydrogen atom, are strongly affected by the finite size of the proton. The larger the proton is, the less bound is the muon. And therefore, by measuring energy level, we can deduce, by using complicated mathematics, we can deduce then the size of the proton.
Okay, so how do your findings about the size of the proton fit with previous measurements?
Well, we measure the proton radius an order of magnitude more precise than the previous measurement from hydrogen and from scattering. So we are a factor of 10 more precise than from the other method. But our values strongly disagree with previous determination.
Is that what you expected to find?
No, not at all. We wanted simply to measure the proton radius more precisely. So we were really astonished to see this deviation. So our proton radius value was 4% smaller than previous value.
I was going to say, you talked about the two different methods, scattering and spectroscopy. You talked about these two different methods before. Did they agree with each other? Is this a third measure that's along a spectrum, or is it in the middle? Or
the two other methods, scattering and hydrogen spectroscopy, they agree with each other, but they have much larger error bar compared to our measurement. And we are much more precise, but we are off.
So you're seeing a big difference between your measurement, which is more precise, and older measurements that were pretty close together. What does that mean for the different aspects of particle physics or nuclear physics?
There are, at the moment, there are no solution for this so-called proton radius. And that's triggered a lot of investigation in this various field. And there are several communities from atomic physics, nuclear physics, and particle physics which try to understand this discrepancy. First of all, this discrepancy may be originating only from a mistake in one of the three experiments. But if we can exclude in the next year this problem, then we should ask if there are a more serious problem in the theory, like bound state of atoms, so theories which describe the interaction of charged particle with light, so-called bound state QD theory, or that something we don't understand about the proton structure, or even there are also investigation regarding so-called new physics, if there is some kind of physics beyond the standard model which could explain this difference. So, for example, that the muon is interacting differently as an electron.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Aldo Antonini and colleagues write about the proton radius puzzle in this week's Science.
Hi there, podcast listeners. This week, as in the past few weeks, our podcast is being sponsored by Audible.com. So this week, we're recommending a few audiobooks to go with some of the themes of the show.
By going to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get one of the audiobooks we recommend here or another of your own choosing for free. So, Carrie, let's start with what you would pick.
Well, this was an easy one, Sarah. There are so many books on conservation and the environment, I decided to go back to the beginning. I picked Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, a seminal book in the environmental movement.
How about you? Well, after a bit of clicking around in the physics section, I realized they have another oldie but goodie, the Feynman Lectures on Physics, which are hands down the most entertaining way to get a grip on some pretty complex physics.
Indeed. So, podcast listeners, check out these books and more, and get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. To date, roughly 1.5 million species have been identified on Earth, which could either be a substantial chunk or barely a scratch on the surface of the Earth's diversity. We don't know which, because estimates for the total number of species have ranged from 2 million to 100 million. Because many species, discovered or not, are rapidly going extinct, taxonomists worry that many will fade out before we get a chance to catalog them. With a quantitative review of some of these variables, Mark Costello and colleagues offer some optimism in a field that's grown to be quite pessimistic.
People were fearful because there's so few taxonomists, and there's potentially tens of millions of species on Earth, and we've only discovered 1 or 2 million. And these alarming rates of extinction, that most species will go extinct before we'll even find them, both because there's so many to be discovered, the rates of extinction are so high, and because of declining numbers of taxonomists. The history of it was we started putting together databases on how many species we know on Earth, and we discovered in doing this that there was far more people describing species than we'd realized. And we also wondered what the consequence was of compiling this list of species on Earth, and what do we know? One of the consequences is you can start looking at what we don't know, and the other is trying to estimate extinction rates. So in this paper, we sort of pulled together, well, if we look at the rate of discovery of species and how many more species are to be found, and we look at the rates of extinction, and we look at the taxonomic effort that's going into it, what does this tell us about the consequences for the future discovery of life on Earth?
And this stems from, how some ecologists are despairing that species are going to be going extinct too fast for us to catalog them.
Yeah, there's a rich literature, actually, and people saying that taxonomists are going extinct almost as fast as their species, and many websites on this. And I was always a little bit circumspect about this because you don't really see anybody looking at counting the numbers of how many people there are. And the most well-known taxonomists are always retiring. Like in many professions, the best-known people are best known near the ends of their careers. But in these databases, when you describe a species, you also associate that name with the name of the person who described it and the year they described it. So we were able to look in the database and see exactly how many people are naming species each year over the last 250 years.
Right. So what are some numbers? You know, how many taxonomists are out there, and why were we so fearful that the world was, you know, running out of taxonomists?
Yeah, so when we looked at the numbers for the last decade, we've done a calculation in the paper, and this estimates that there's at least about 47,000 people have named species in
Wow.
the last decade. And that's a huge number, and quite surprised everybody. And that's just the people who've named species. There's many people who are taxonomists who wouldn't have named a species in that 10 years. They may be experts in species classification or the identification of species in well-known countries.
And then part of the uncertainty in the question of whether or not we'll be able to catalog species before they go extinct is that we're not quite sure how many species are actually out there. So, you know, what are some of the numbers that have been thrown around for the number of species on Earth, and how can we determine which estimates are actually reliable?
Yeah, well, this has been debated actually for centuries, and there's been hugely varying estimates. I think a couple of hundred years ago, people estimated a few thousand species on Earth. Then a few decades ago, people were estimating 10 million, 30 million in the tropical rainforests alone, or 100 million if we included the deep sea. But all these estimates were done with very, very limited data, and usually extrapolation from a few samples to the whole world. So in the last couple of years, statisticians have got into this and looked at the numbers more carefully and started applying confidence limits. And in all these cases, they reduced these estimates down to around 10 million or even less. And one of the recent estimates is that there may be only 2 or 3 million species on Earth.
And which do you think are most reliable? How can we judge?
It's very hard to be sure because the later species to be found will be the rarest ones. And we know when we look at any area that most species are rare. So it's very hard to predict this long tail of rare species you get in the distribution of abundance.
Hmm.
You can look at expert opinion. You can look at the number of undescribed species discovered in samples. You can use statistical models to extrapolate from what we know already. And I think it's best to look at all these different methods and see when you start getting the same answer with several methods.
And then, of course, there's the rate of extinctions, another nebulous estimate. You know, how fast are species going extinct? What are some numbers being thrown around for that?
Yeah, so the numbers being thrown around for that range from anything from 0.01% of species on Earth per decade up to 5% of species
Wow.
on Earth per decade. So this is a huge range. And my co-authors are really more experts in the rates of extinction, and I hadn't looked at this before, and I thought we're making very poor estimates of how many species are on Earth. Surely the estimates of extinction rates are better, but in fact, they're arguably worse.
Hmm.
And that is in part because it depends on how many species exist on Earth. So they're all sort of connected. And if you're assuming that there's very high number of species on Earth, then you end up with very high extinction rates.
Right. Either way, it's still very alarming, you know, however fast it is, that so many are going extinct.
Yeah, even the lower estimates are quite serious. And it's difficult to compare these rates to what happened in the fossil record because that's measured over millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
But it does look like the rates in the last 200 years are higher and comparable to what happened in the mass extinction events in the fossil record.
So given all of these different estimates of number of species extinctions, and then that we also have, you know, tens of thousands of active taxonomists out there trying to catalog new species, how many new species are being discovered, and how do these rates all compare?
Over the last 10 years, there have been about 17,000 species on average described per year. And this
Wow.
is quite an amazing number.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, most of us didn't realize it was so many. But then when you start looking at the numbers again, you find, well, actually, there are quite a lot of people out there doing this, both professionals and amateurs. About half of the new species described within Europe are by people who don't have a professional address.
Hmm.
So it's a significant number of members of the public are involved in this process as well. So when you start putting these things together, well, actually, there are a lot of taxonomists. Their numbers are increasing, especially in Asia and South America, regions of the world with lots of species. Significant members of the public are being involved. We're exploring all the furthest corners of the Earth nowadays. We're probably in a golden age of discovery. The effort and ability to find new species has never been as good. So the reason we're continuing to have a linear kind of rate of discovery of new species is because the effort is increasing, but the actual number of species being described is not increasing as much as the effort, which suggests that, you know, it actually is getting harder to discover new species already.
Right. As we discover more and more species, there will be fewer and fewer remaining species to be found. So this all comes back to our original question and also the title of your paper, Can We Name Earth Species Before They Go Extinct? So what do you think? What's the answer to that question and what would it take to get us there?
Well, already we're on the right track, which is very promising in two senses. One, there's increased effort, and it also gets much more exciting to discover species as it gets harder. There's great media interest, and during the Census and Marine Life program, the media really picked up on how many species are being discovered, and the more unusual their pictures, the better.
Hmm.
So there's a great public interest in discovery, and going and discovering life on other planets is in the media regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put all this together, and then you look that extinction rates haven't been as bad as people have worried about, and this is for several reasons, one being that we're doing something about it, and we're preventing species going extinct, we're trying to protect habitats from being lost. The second reason is species can sometimes survive in secondary habitats. So like if the forest gets clear felled, some species can survive in the scrub and bush that survives afterwards, and then they can recolonize the forest if it regrows.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an opportunity now to actually discover all species because of all these factors coming together, and increased communication and the use of the internet and online information is making this knowledge available to everybody. So it's much easier for people to kind of go out and say, I've got something really new. Can I find an expert that can tell me what it is? And if it's a new species, then hopefully it'll get described very quickly.
So you're confident that we can beat the extinction clock and name Earth species before they go extinct?
Yes, yes, I think I am. And I think we could probably discover more species within this century. And this century is kind of critical because we've got climate change and other factors coming upon us which may act as a kind of a double hit to extinction rates, because they may increase extinction rates, but probably not as fast as habitat loss will.
Hmm.
So with the increased education and awareness of societies around the world about what they might lose, I think there's a very good chance that we can protect most species from extinction and discover them in time as well. And this discovery process helps conservation, because it's very hard to protect a species when you don't know it exists.
Mm-hmm.
But once you know it exists, you know where it exists, what habitat it's in, and lots of other information.
Great. Well, Mark Costello, thank you so much.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Mark Costello and colleagues review a big challenge for modern taxonomy in this week's issue.
Scientist, study thyself, or so say Ferrick Fang and Arturo Casadevall, a pair of crusading scientists that have taken on the task of using science to improve the practice of science. I spoke with Jennifer Cousin Frankel about her profile of these investigators.
I was familiar with some of the publications of Ferrick Fang and Arturo Casadevall, and I knew they'd been writing about retractions and scientific misconduct, which is an area that I've been interested in and have covered in the past. And what struck me was that some of their work was extremely labor-intensive. It seemed like it really required a great deal of time to do what they were doing. I know these are busy people, and I was just wondering what was motivating them. They seemed very focused on this, and I wanted to learn more what was behind that.
So maybe it's who you're writing about, and maybe it's that you're profiling two people at the same time, but this is a really far-ranging story. Let's talk about your subjects a little bit. Ferrick Fang and Arturo Casadevall. Who are these guys?
Well, they are both microbiologists, and Dr. Casadevall also is an immunologist. They're both really quite prominent in their field. One is at the University of Washington in Seattle. The other, Arturo, is in the Bronx at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and they do a lot of well-known science. But they also have an interest in studying, I guess what I think of as the science of science, how we do science and what some of the issues are in science, how things can change for the better.
Mm-hmm. So besides being scientists in their field, they're very much interested in the structure of science, how it's practiced, how it could be improved. What sparked their interest in this topic?
I think they came at it from different places. I'm going to use their first names just for ease, but Ferrick is sort of a very thoughtful, very meticulous guy. He was appointed the editor-in-chief of a journal called Infection and Immunity several years back, and that got him thinking about publications and journals, as becoming an editor of a journal often does for scientists. Arturo was one of the editors at that journal as well, so they were working together somewhat. They knew each other a little bit, not all that well, but they certainly knew each other by name, and they'd met at a couple of meetings. And Ferrick recognized that as editor-in-chief, he had the ability to write editorials in the journal along with his editors. So he started canvassing his editors and seeing if anyone had topics that they were interested in writing about for the journal.
Mm-hmm.
And as Ferrick told me, the one who stepped forward was Arturo. So that was really the origin of their partnership in 2008.
So they've tended to focus on a couple major issues in science, including scientific misconduct. How did that come about?
So they were writing some of their editorials, thinking about science, the different ways we do science, how science is described. And then there was essentially a misconduct case at the Journal of Infection and Immunity. Ferrick was notified a few years back that a Japanese researcher had manipulated certain images that mm-hmm. were published in different papers in that journal. And this isn't unheard of. There are cases like this that come up now and again for journal editors, but the case really shook him. And he really felt that the misconduct, which did lead to several retractions of those papers, had been uncovered very much by chance, by a reviewer for a different journal who was reviewing a paper by this individual and noticed a problem with the images. And that made him wonder how much more science out there has not been corrected. So they started together to look at retractions in the published literature and what was behind those retractions.
So as you say in your story, they do some very energy-intensive research here. They hand comb through data from PubMed, and they've got some really interesting results. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. So they've published several different papers, particularly in the misconduct and retraction area. One that I think got a lot of coverage looked at every retraction they could find in the published literature. And I think, if I remember right, there were about 2,000 or a little more than 2,000 going back to the 70s. And essentially, they were trying to determine what had caused those retractions. So obviously, not every retraction is caused because someone is faking data. People might make errors that really affect the substance of a paper and then have to retract it. And obviously, that's no fun for the scientist, but mistakes do happen. I think their expectation going in was that a lot of these retractions would be due to honest errors.
Right.
But as it turned out, they found that about two-thirds were due to misconduct, as they described it. In addition, they felt that some of the retractions were not really clearly described in the literature. So there might be a retraction, and it would be sort of suggested in the retraction, often by the author of the original study, that there had been some sort of error, but then they were cross-referencing these retractions with misconduct investigations, and they found that some of those that suggested that errors were the problem were actually due to misconduct.
So they were pretty surprised by this result, that misconduct was so widespread, and they kind of use that as a way to talk about some of the overarching problems in science. So why do they think that so much of this misconduct is going on? What are the underlying factors?
One thing that both have thought about and are also starting to look at is the system in which scientists work and the pressures on scientists. And those pressures really include getting funding, getting money, because without it, you can't go anywhere, and often you don't even have a salary, and also to get publications. And those two are really intertwined. So what they've started realizing is that there are pressures on scientists that can really contribute to some of that bad scientific behavior, which again doesn't necessarily excuse it, but it may help explain some of it.
In terms of, you know, getting funding or getting published, how did those kinds of pressures work themselves out into scientific misconduct?
Well, there are people out there who have studied cheating, and these two scientists have looked at some of that research. And what that suggests is that if you create an environment that puts certain pressures on people, that encourages misbehavior, even not explicitly, of course, but maybe rewards misbehavior in certain ways, people are more likely to cheat, or that's at least tempting people to cheat. And it's difficult to expect people to behave well in an environment like that. And I think what Farrick and Arturo worry is that science has shifted somewhat, so there is more of that environment. There is this tremendous pressure to publish in high-impact journals because that can affect your ability to get a job or to get promoted, and there's this tremendous pressure to get funding, and as the funding rates have gone down, it's become more and more difficult to get funding. So those pressures have really increased over the years.
And so the stakes are really high. All you have to do is smudge something a little bit in Photoshop, and you can change your life.
In theory.
These two scientists, you know, they also lead labs, they're editors of journals, so they are deeply involved in the enterprise of science. So what are they doing to solve some of these problems, and what solutions do they propose in general?
Well, I think that's a tall order, and they're still very much trying to understand what the problems even are and really quantify them and determine where we might even need solutions. So I would say there are certain things that they have thought about, which I don't talk about all that much in the story, but different ways to distribute funding, perhaps to not have salaries of scientists tied closely to grants, so you at least know you have a salary you can count on, even if you still need grant money. And there are certain areas of science where that is generally how funding works. For example, in the VA, the Veterans Administration System, in the NIH intramural program, people who are working within NIH have something like that system in place. Now, we don't know for sure that people who are in that system are less likely to commit misconduct, but it's certainly a possibility. So they're thinking of different ways like that. I think Arturo is interested in people just thinking more broadly, learning more broadly, not being super, super, super specialized like they are now in their own labs. Farrick has his students and postdocs working on multiple projects to try and reduce the pressure on them. So they're thinking of different ways, but I think they also recognize that they can't really come up with all the solutions here. That's too much to ask,
right,
and it's not necessarily reasonable, but they're hoping, I think, that if they keep putting this information out there as they try to study science and how it works, others might start to think of solutions. But of course, it could take a long time for anything to really change.
All right, Jennifer, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel is a new staff writer for Science. She writes about the roots of scientific fraud in this week's issue.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, our first story discusses using DNA as a programming language.
Carrie, we don't really think of DNA for storing information, although I guess for genetic information we do think about it, but we don't really think about storing our movies, our pictures, books on DNA, but that's just what scientists are doing. In fact, actually last year, a group of scientists showed that they could store a book in DNA. And now scientists have taken that a step farther. They've actually stored 2.2 petabytes per gram in DNA. And actually at that concentration, you could store the information in 468,000 DVDs in just a single gram of DNA.
Wow. So this is a really fun proof of principle. That's amazing. But, you know, I don't know how to write information in DNA, and I don't own a DNA sequencer. How practical is this? Who would this be practical for?
Well, you know, it seems kind of a weird thing to do, and it seems not very practical. But it turns out, you know, with the massive amount of data we're generating these days, not just our home movies and home pictures, but when you think about giant science experiments like the Large Hadron Collider, which produces 15 petabytes of data each year, these projects need massive amounts of storage capacity. And right now what they do is they store their data on magnetic tape. That's okay, but keeping data safe over many decades requires writing and rewriting on this tape and get very expensive and onerous. The advantage of DNA is that it's stable for thousands of years. So once you're encoding it, you really don't have to do anything with it for a long, long time. And it's very, very stable.
Wow. So how does one actually encode information into DNA?
Well, the team developed a trinary code in contrast to the binary code that a lot of us are familiar with, the code of ones and zeros. A trinary code is a code of ones, zeros, and twos. And they were able to translate that into the various chemical bases of DNA, the A's, the G's, the C's, and the T's that make up our genetic code.
So how expensive is this whole process? When will this actually be economical to do? Is it already?
Well, it's actually not very economical right now, just because the cost of synthesizing DNA and sequencing DNA is actually still very high. And so right now, it's only cost effective if you want to store data for 600 years or more, because otherwise, it's actually cheaper to just keep writing or rewriting magnetic tape. But the cost of DNA synthesis and reading continue to go down, and researchers suspect that very soon it will be cost effective to store in DNA versus magnetic tape, even if you want to store something for only about 50 years.
So like you said, the biggest benefit here would be that DNA is really stable for long periods of time, but is it as versatile as other kinds of data storage media that we have now?
Well, Carrie, there's a couple downsides. One is that you can't change or rewrite the data once it's encoded. Hmm. And that gives it a big disadvantage over other kinds of storage media. The other problem is you can't access right now a particular piece of information. So you can't sort of zoom in on a file like you would maybe on a DVD or a CD. What you have to do is actually sequence large swaths of DNA to find the information that you want. So that's not very practical either, although one suspects that both of these hurdles will probably be overcome in the not-too distant future.
It's that last one is kind of like having to fast forward or rewind through.
Exactly. It's like going back to the days of VHS tapes,
right?
For those of you who remember what those are.
Well, great. I look forward to hearing more about this. And in another genetic story, we're taking a closer look at the evolution of man's best friend.
Right. We're looking at DNA again in this story, but we're looking at DNA for its sort of classical purpose, which is to show us what genes make up an organism and how an organism changes over time. And the organism we're looking at right now is the dog, one of everybody's favorite or maybe two favorite organisms out there besides people. But anyway, there's been a lot of interest in how dogs became domesticated. People suspect that dogs became domesticated about 10,000 or more years ago when humans first began to settle down and start farming, although some say it was a lot longer ago than that. And dogs obviously aren't the same as the wolves they came from. They look different. And this new study shows that they actually digest a lot different than wolves do, too.
So what kinds of foods are we talking about that dogs and wolves differ on?
Well, what the researchers found was there seems to be a vast difference in the ability of dogs to digest starch. So we're talking about, you know, things that are present in grains like wheat and rice, which obviously would have been very important at the advent of farming. What the researchers found is they honed in on 36 regions of doggy DNA, and they found 122 genes that seemed different than what wolves have. They compared a few breeds of dogs to a few groups of wolves. And they found that 19 of these regions contain genes that are important for the brain, 8 of which are involved in the nervous system development, which makes sense if you think about that dogs are behaviorally different than wolves, so they may have had stuff differently going on in their brains. But what was really surprising were that these researchers found a lot of these differences had to do with genes that are important for digesting starch. Dogs, for example, have 4 to 30 copies of the gene for amylase, which is a protein that starts the breakdown of starch in the intestines, whereas wolves only have 2 copies. What it all comes down to is that dogs should be about 5-fold better than wolves at digesting starch.
And what would have necessitated this digestion of starch? Where would that have come from?
Well, you can imagine wolves in the wild are eating a lot of meat, but when we have dogs, we have animals that are feasting on our leftovers, feasting on the garbage piles that we're producing when we've really settled down. You know, in these garbage piles, you're seeing maybe a little bit of meat, but you're also seeing a lot of other waste products, wheat and rice, you know, just sort of the leftovers. And dogs that were more evolutionarily adapted to eat these other foods, these starchy foods, did a lot better, produced more offspring, and made it on to the next generation.
How interesting. So the evolution of these wolves and dogs' diets sort of parallels the evolution of human diets.
Exactly.
So does this mean that I should be feeding my dog mashed potatoes?
That's a great question, because there's a lot of controversy right now in the dog feeding world about whether we should be feeding our dogs like wolves, whether they really need this raw meat ancestral diet. Mm-hmm. And this study suggests that they don't. This study suggests that dogs are not just wolves, that they're much different, that they've evolved differently, and that they are able to eat a lot of the variety of foods that we do. And so maybe a lot of the stuff we feed them now that has these grains, the rice, and the wheat in it may actually be very well adapted to their digestive system.
How interesting. And of course, another parallel is the paleo diet and other things that go back to our own human roots.
Very much so.
And in our final story, what social media can tell us about our memory.
We don't think, Carrie, about Facebook being very important to science. It's maybe a very important way for us to while away some of the hours of the day. But this new study suggests that there's some stuff going on Facebook that actually tells a lot about how our brains form memories.
Tell me more.
Well, you know, think about the status updates on Facebook. They're not always the most, shall we say, novelistic writing. You know, in this study, they pick some choice phrases from status updates, things like, sometimes it makes me wonder, the library is a place to study, not to talk on your phone, and I like the smell of clean bed sheets. Not exactly the type of sentences that are going to change world literature. But the interesting thing researchers found in this study, they actually showed some of these phrases to undergraduate students, and they compared them to phrases that had been taken from a few recent books, phrases like, underneath the mass of facial hair beamed a large smile, and even honor had its limits, things more of classic literature. And what they found that was really surprising was that these students actually had a much easier time remembering the phrases on Facebook than the sentences from novels.
So I wonder if there could be an emotional context there when I'm reading status updates from friends, you know, other people that I care about, and I care about their opinion.
Well, that's what the researchers thought at first. And what they did was they actually tried to see if people were just remembering these posts because they just sort of had more of a social connection with maybe the post writers. But when the researchers repeated this experiment and asked the subjects to rate the post based on how much the Facebook post sounded like somebody they knew, they didn't see any correlation. So the social aspect didn't really seem to enter into it. And the other idea they had was, well, maybe, you know, Facebook posts were more sort of self-contained thoughts than what you might see in a novel. But when they tested this, they also found that that wasn't the case.
Really? So what could it be then? What could be the key there?
Well, the researchers think that it really comes down to how unfiltered Facebook remarks are. Effortless chatter, they say, is better than well-crafted sentences at tapping into our mind's basic language capacity. So we don't tend to think in novelistic thoughts.
Right.
We don't communicate in novelistic thoughts. So we're probably less likely to remember those types of thoughts than more conversational thoughts, which are also the kind of thoughts that you see on Facebook.
How interesting. So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how dung beetles use starlight to guide their way. Also a story about a group of whales that have adopted a deformed dolphin. And there's a very compelling slideshow that goes along with that. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the future of the NIH's research chimps. Also a story about whether men or women are more likely to engage in scientific misconduct. You'll have to check out the site to find the answer to that. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is on the future of supercomputers. And next week's chat is about the science of gun research. What are scientific studies telling us about the impacts of guns and gun violence? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Very timely. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Gary.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the January 25th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.